May it please the court. My name is Dan Goldberg, and I represent Mr. Cooper in this appeal. The district court here erred in sentencing Mr. Cooper because it improperly relied in implying the guidelines, it relied solely on pre-plea conduct in denying acceptance of responsibility. I think at the outset, we need to acknowledge that there's no on-point binding Eighth Circuit case law that holds whether or not a district court can rely solely on pre-plea conduct. And I think we know that from the Millsaps case, where just recently a panel of this court assumed without deciding the issue, presumably reserving it for later review. So I think what this court needs to turn first to is the text of 3E1.1, because that's the best evidence to resolve this issue. And I think panels of this court have done a good job in the past in doing just that. The Bell Court, for example, looked to the term responsible and saw that it's defined as, quote, to answer for one's conduct. So when does one answer for one's conduct? I think that's rather unambiguous in the federal criminal justice system. It's one where one pleads guilty, because prior to that time, you have an absolute right to go to trial, refuse to take acceptance, and require the government to prove you guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. I think we also know that because the surest way to lose acceptance of responsibility is to do the opposite, to go to trial, not take acceptance of responsibility, and then later at sentencing try to show remorse. That won't work. We know that, again, from the Bell case. So I think the text of 3E1.1 is very helpful. The purpose of the rule, I think, is also very helpful, and I think that's also unambiguous. The Sentencing Commission wants defendants to plead guilty swiftly, because if they don't, we know that in the criminal justice system, you know, approximately 90% or more plead guilty. And if that weren't the case, there would be a floodgates, and the system couldn't handle that. So they want to give reward defendants for doing that swiftly. So the government
counsel, I have a question about that. I think the case law is pretty clear that, and the guideline is clear that pleading guilty is not a guarantee for that reduction. So does that cut into your argument a little bit, that to put too much emphasis on that, that there are two different assessments, pleading guilty and actually accepting responsibility, which does in fact take in a number of other factors other than simply admitting the elements of the offense?
I think you're absolutely right. Pleading guilty is not dispositive. It's significant evidence, but I think absolutely that doesn't entitle you to the two-level reduction. Our argument is that if you plead guilty and then do something subsequent to that that's inconsistent with that acceptance, then absolutely you should lose that acceptance of responsibility.
But, Mr. Goldberg, this is Jed Smith. Is there anything in the guideline that could be read to prohibit the consideration of pre-plea conduct?
My argument is that the plain language is prohibitive.
What language specifically?
Well, that to answer for one's conduct, okay? Anything that happens before one answers for one's conduct is irrelevant, because that's the not only symbolic, that's the legal time where you actually go and say, I did it. I'm taking responsibility. And then I'd also turn to application note 1B. Okay. And I think that's the only one that's on point to address this issue. And it says that an appropriate consideration is, quote, voluntary termination or withdrawal from criminal conduct or associations, end quote. So Chief Judge Smith, what's not in that language is prior to the adjudication of guilt. And we see that language in application note 1C, that a voluntary payment of restitution needs to be done, and the courts should look to prior to adjudication of guilt. That's not in there as it pertains to voluntary termination withdrawal from criminal conduct. So I think one could say, hey, the Sentencing Commission knows how to put that in. And since they didn't, that should be given.
What about application note 1.1A, which has the language in it describing appropriate considerations that they include but are not limited to, so that there's a range of things that can be appropriately considered, including voluntary termination or withdrawal from criminal conduct or associations, whether they surrendered voluntarily and promptly. Those are things that could be considered as behavior occurring before the plea.
Right. I think that you are absolutely right that there's that language that says, but are not limited to. And so there's the notion that district courts should be given discretion to consider what they think is important and seeing if there's acceptance or responsibility. But I think the problem,
I guess my second and last question, because I don't want to eat up your time, but why wouldn't it be appropriate for a court to take into account serious criminal behavior by a person who's pleading to a separate offense when the court is trying to consider whether the person has demonstrated that they should receive a more lenient sentence?
Right. I think why it's not appropriate is that what the government's proposed rule, I think, encourages is the district court to make its own determination as to when that time period begins. Is it before, prior to arrest? Let's say the criminality is ongoing and also during that time commits other crimes that aren't federal crimes, aren't charged. And what I think the government's argument is saying is that, well, defendants should turn themselves in and then they should get acceptance of responsibility. And what I think we need is a more uniform rule that's more consistent, because I think that's what...
Wouldn't that be the kind of rule that the commission would need to make instead of appellate courts?
Mr. Cooper's argument is that they already have, that 3E1.1 is unambiguous. And here, I'm here to admit that we're seeking a transformation of the law. That's not how the law is in the Eighth Circuit right now. But I think there's no other court better fit to take a look at the plain language and the purpose of the rule and to make a correct analysis of it. And that just because, you know, other circuits aren't doing it, you know, this isn't a broadly interpreted rule this way, doesn't mean that other circuits are doing it right. You know, you see cases like the Rehave case, where courts are just collectively misinterpreting the law. And I think it's important not to lose the forest for the trees. Here we have Mr. Cooper. He pled guilty within almost 3 months of being indicted. That's exactly what we want. And if the court were to interpret this rule otherwise, you're giving Mr. Cooper and so many that others like him no incentive to plead guilty. He might as well go to trial, take his chances with the jury, and juries are unpredictable. Maybe they'll acquit him. And I think that's the contrary to what we want. Unless there's other questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Goldberg. Mr. Coppe?
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Phil Coppe, and I represent the government in this case. About the only thing I think I agree with Mr. Goldberg on, and it's really not in my brief, is he does take issue with my assertion that the decision as to whether or not to give acceptance of responsibility is discretionary. Now, that's all correct, but I think he is right that the question that this court is asked to decide in this case, can the court consider pre-plea conduct? That probably is a de novo review, because that's a question of law. Now, where I don't agree with him is he says this is an open question, and the only authority he has for this is that footnote that says we don't need to decide it in this case. And he says that proves, that unpublished opinion, that footnote proves that this is an open question. And, you know, during oral arguments this week, one of the things that came up was a question. He mentioned Rehafe, and there's a case that recently came down from the court, Brooks Davis, where Judge Loken said, we don't need to decide whether a stipulation by itself is sufficient. Well, as we pointed out in argument, that's already been decided in the Lamont Owens case. So he overlooked it. And obviously, whoever wrote the per curiam unpublished opinion in Millsaps overlooked the fact that the case law is clear. Now, in his reply brief, Mr. Goldberg says we're asking for two different standards. We're not. What we're saying is that the guidelines, as they are formulated and as they have been interpreted by this court, allow a court to take into consideration in determining whether a defendant is entitled to acceptance of responsibility any conduct that occurs subsequent to the commission of the offense. That's what the case law says. And quite frankly, he has to acknowledge, and we haven't cited all of the cases. This is just a representative sample. One of the cases that we cite was the Honken case, H-O-N-K-E-N, and he said it doesn't stand for what I said it says, and I looked it up, and it does. But in the process of looking up the Honken case, I see two more cases that support our argument that are cited in that opinion that we don't cite.
Mr. Coppe, I do let's assume for purposes of this question that the district court is free to look at pre-plea conduct. The guidelines do, however, focus and say that the evidence of a guilty plea, I think that the language is, may be outweighed by the conduct of the defendant that is inconsistent with such acceptance of responsibility. Do you think that in this case the district court really focused on that language and determining, making a factual finding as to why this particular conduct, pre-plea conduct, was inconsistent with accepting responsibility for a very different offense?
Well, I do, Your Honor, because I, you know, there is a presumption that the district court knows the law. And as we point out in our brief, the case law is quite clear that the acts that have been committed by a defendant do not have to specifically relate to the crime for which he's pleading guilty. And so, therefore, the fact that it didn't, for example, it didn't involve as, well, in the Honken case, which is a really serious example, witnesses started disappearing. I mean, I don't mean, you know, hiding. They were, like, not to be found.
And I understand your point, Mr. Cubby. I was just, the inconsistent with acceptance of responsibility, whether or not the conduct is directly related to the offense to which the person is pled guilty, there still seems to be a fact finding there required to show why this particular pre-plea conduct shows is inconsistent with a plea of guilty to other conduct. Can you speak to that a little bit as to whether sort of seems to be a different question than are the two types of conduct related?
Right. All right. Well, even assuming, and in this case, they are unrelated, but the case law basically says is that the scope of acceptance of responsibility is not limited simply to pleading guilty and saving the government time. That's a big deal, and of course, we're all in favor of that. But the case law says that one of the factors, and they list a whole bunch of these factors, that factors are ceasing criminal activity. And it doesn't say any particular activity. I mean, one of the things that we point out in our brief, and I think it's correct, is that if you look at the factors under 3E1.1, you know, truthfully admitting or not falsely denying conduct. You know, there are cases that say that individuals who have been arrested, you know, haven't even been charged yet and who lie about it, you know, they violate that. Voluntarily terminating or withdrawing from criminal activity, and it doesn't have to be related. Voluntarily surrendering to authorities promptly, that conduct can only take place before an arrest. And it seems to me, as I point out in our brief, it totally undercuts his argument that you can't consider that. Voluntary assistance to authorities in recovery of the fruits, of course, that can be at any point. Voluntary resignation from office, post-offense rehabilitative efforts, counseling, drug treatment. Obviously, if it's a drug offense, that sort of thing can occur before. And as the McLaughlin case points out, this is a two-edged sword because we're arguing for a rule, or I think the court, we're not really arguing for the rule, it is the rule, but this court has acknowledged that, you know, I would look pretty foolish, it seems to me, if I was arguing, let's say this were a bankruptcy, a bank robbery case, and if the defendant, after committing the bank robbery, has second thoughts, turns around, walks back, gives the money back, and waits for the police to arrest him, I would be pretty foolish to argue that that couldn't be considered as evidence of acceptance of responsibility, because I think that is the most, you know, potent acceptance. By contrast, if he, in fleeing the bank, runs over a bunch of people and then doesn't stop to aid them, that seemingly shows non-acceptance of responsibility. And of course, there's cases that have pointed that out. Assault cases on Indian reservations where the individual hasn't helped the person, they've walked away. And this is even pre-arrest. So I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but I think the court certainly was aware of the case law, and and the court is saying, if you're committing some sort of assaultive conduct or engaging in some serious offense 13 days before you plead guilty, you're not eschewing criminal conduct. And it doesn't matter that, you know, you're not attempting to do something to affect this prosecution. Part of acceptance of responsibility involves things like repentance. Now, Mr. Goldberg's response is, well, we can't ask him to be repentant because that's religious and that's going to violate his freedom of religion. And, you know, the cases that I'm quoting from are, I mean, they use those words. They're your court's cases. I don't think that they mean that in a religious context. They mean it in the context of you have figured out that, no, I'm not going to go down this path. So it has
Mr. Coppe, I think we've gotten this point. I had some concern as I read the transcript that if you listen and read the words that Judge Sachs actually used, is that it looked like we were trying this state-related conduct, and it really was going to dangerousness far more than it was going to the question of did he accept responsibility, you know. And at the end, it seemed to me that particularly there was a moment, and I don't have the transcript right in front of me right at this second, where he said that you know, that he thought that what we were talking about, those two levels was, or three levels, wasn't enough. And it seemed that they were focused in on the conduct, the underlying criminal conduct, much more than they were focused in on did he accept responsibility or not. And to me, there's a difference there, because while 3E1.1 has all kinds of flexibility, I think, and I think the arguments you're making are sound, but I think that there's something else going on here beyond just trying to tie it to whether he had really accepted responsibility, that there's something else going on here about future dangerousness. And that shows up in the colloquy when he gets around to sentencing too. I mean, and are we just supposed to ignore all of that and just say, hey, he knew the law, and therefore, although these things that he says seem to be, you know, I mean, I could have got there at 3553A and his variance. I'm just having a hard time figuring out in the guidelines whether it ties in.
Well,
so
I guess
why shouldn't that be a concern for me?
Okay, the answer that I would give you, Judge, is this: is that I think it goes to both. I mean, in the sentencing proceeding, you know, one of the future dangerous, of course, is an issue, but it also, I mean, it's necessarily tied into the question of are you refraining? Have you stopped criminal conduct? And in this case, obviously, the more serious the conduct, I mean, if he's getting a jaywalking ticket or something, that would be one thing. But he's saying, if I read the record correctly, that, you know, you've not only not ceased criminal activity, but you're engaging in really serious activity. And I guess my answer to you would be, you could look at that both from a context of not accepting responsibility. You can also look at it as future dangerous. And again, I think they kind of blend together, but I don't think that violates the guidelines. I think that corresponds to the guidelines. It's just maybe two different things you're looking at separately, but they both factor in.
Thank you, Mr. Coppe.
I see I'm out of time. So unless there are any questions, I would urge the court to affirm the lower court's decision.
Thank you, Mr. Coppe. Mr. Goldberg, your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think I want to respond to the government's argument about the case law because I think there is a lot of case law out there. I think the government has to acknowledge there isn't a uniform applicable rule that gives bright line tests to courts as to when the time starts. And here, even the district court said, you know, the time has to start somewhere, and I think that's at the guilty plea. And then I think, as Judge Erickson pointed out, you kind of got in the weeds about dangerousness, so that's concerning. And I think in some of the, a lot of the case law that the government cites too, he has First Circuit cases, he has unpublished cases, he has cases that occurred before the 1990 amendment to the guidelines. So you have a lot of cases that I just don't think resolve the issue.
Mr. Goldberg?
Yes, Your Honor.
What's your response to Mr. Coppi's position that if the rule that you are advocating was put in place, it would cut both ways? And a defendant who wants the court to consider the fact that they withdrew from their criminal enterprise in the process, that wouldn't be able to be considered because it was pre-plea conduct.
Right. I think that it, as it pertains to the criminality, that is a unique cutout, and that other things like, you know, the other application notes like 1C, if you're going to make a voluntary payment, clearly the Sentencing Commission wants you, the courts, to look to before he takes acceptance responsibility. But this is a unique cutout that pertains to accepting responsibility and has it pertains to future criminality under 1B. So I think you can look at that not as a two-way street. That's a unique cutout, if that makes sense, if that addresses your question, Your Honor.
Well, as I understood, what you're proposing is that we put in an interpretation that would say that pre-plea conduct would not be considered for purposes of determining acceptance of responsibility.
Not as it pertains to criminal, ceasing criminal conduct. I think that, again, there's this notion, I think it's a valid one, is that when you come up to a judge and you make a factual basis for that guilty conduct, that's a very unique event. And so it should be treated uniquely and not like paying restitution voluntarily beforehand.
Thank you, Mr. Goldberg. Thank you also, Mr. Coppi. Court appreciates both counsel's presence before us this morning, the argument you provided, and the briefing that's been submitted, and we'll take the case under advisement. Counsel may be excused.